Welcome to the Thriveology Lab podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Neil Utterback, that's me.
And Phil Dunwoody, that's me. Neil and I are both on the faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. So today's topic is doing hard things, right? This is the title of this. And we're going to discuss, we're going to discuss kind of why this is part of our well-being model, why this is part of our thriving model, why it's important to us. We're going to talk about some of the research, and we're going to do that by looking both at physical hard things and what you might consider mental, emotional, hard things, because they operate in a lot of similar ways, right? So we're going to discuss some of kind of brain changes, some strategies for doing hard things, and some concepts like distress tolerance, exposure therapy, and even just briefly the concept of grit and growth mindset, and kind of how these relate to doing hard things, and why, in a nutshell, doing hard things is good for you. So let's start with a little bit of like why. So Neil, what's an example in your life where you deliberately did something that was you knew was going to be hard to challenge yourself, and why did you do it, and why do you think that's important?
Well, I'm going to answer this in a couple ways. Because and I think the couple ways it has to do with the fact that even though we, like you and I, are wildly passionate about this, we're not coming to this podcast as people who have all the answers, have it figured out, have it locked in. Like,
oh, I wish.
I wish, right? And like all of the things we're talking about are things that we too are constantly working on, tinkering with. We talk about tinkering all the time, and yeah. So anyway,
the lab part,
yeah. Right, and like it never ends, and new things always creep up. Okay, so yeah. I put all that preamble because it was literally this morning.
Okay, all right.
For those who don't know, I love surfing. I surf because I live in central Pennsylvania. I don't get to go very often. So I'm not very good. I love doing it, but I am not very good at it. Yeah. So I only get to go once or twice a year. But I try to find ways in my landlocked days to get better. And so usually that's, I do CrossFit in the morning, and then I've done like these cable paddles and everything, but it's not quite the same. Swimming is not the same either, but I thought at least I'd be in the water. So last week I joined the Y.
All right.
And so that I would start swimming.
Oh, yeah.
I am not a good swimmer.
Yeah.
And I'm very self-conscious of it. I'm very self-conscious of being in the pool. I don't like being in crowds. The pool at the Y is very crowded.
Yeah.
All of which is to say, like, I talked myself out of going this morning.
Uh-huh. Right. Okay.
Because, like, so, for me, that was both physical and mental, a hard thing.
Yeah.
And even though I knew all the stuff we're about to talk about today.
Yeah, we were just prepping this podcast.
We're prepping this, and I was still thwarted by the social pressure of that, by the physical. Like I was self-conscious of my limited skill ability, and so it's like in retrospect, I wish I had just compelled myself to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And because we're going to talk about today, like why that, if I had compelled myself to do it, some beneficial things would happen. And I guess it's also, I say that as a failure to say, like, it's okay that sometimes we will fail. And I think I've also, it taught me something this morning about myself as well, that doing this, adding this to my life, is going to take a little extra effort than I maybe had anticipated.
It's a good challenge for you.
This is a great, I've identified a very hard thing for me to do.
Yeah. All right. You and I've worked together a long time. We've been friends for a long time. And I know you regularly push yourself and set new goals and challenges. And so I kind of big picture though, like why do you do that? I mean, you do that probably more than I do. You're regularly, you're the Spartans. Mm-hmm. You're kind of regularly setting different, pretty challenging goals for yourself.
Well, I think we'll talk about this as well. I think there is a part of us that intrinsically likes to be challenged, and that's different for everybody. That level is different, and we'll talk about how, in ways in which, like the swimming, we can identify new areas of growth for ourselves. But like, I've always liked putting myself, particularly physically, into challenging or uncomfortable situations, kind of to see what would happen.
Yeah.
I remember like the very first Spartan I did, I thought I was really fit. And then I did that and I was like, oh, I am not.
Yeah.
I am not. I did not expect this. And it was really hard to get through that initial race.
Yeah.
And I remember all the kinds of self-talk I had to do. And like, I didn't drive all this way. I didn't sign up for this thing to quit. So what do I have to do to get through this event? So I think we're going to talk about like, I don't think that I'm actually all that different from people. I think people just have different areas in which they do that.
That's a good point.
And so what's for you, what is a hard thing you have done or seek out?
Of course, there are many things throughout. I mean, when I think back, going through graduate school was definitely one of the more challenging things I had done. That was probably the most demanding environment I think I had been in at that time. It stands out in memory. When I turn, I'm 51 now. When I turned 49, I had never run a half marathon.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, like, okay, I'm not getting any younger. I want to do this. And for me, it's always, I like running trail. I don't run road. So I signed up. I actually ran 6 half marathons that first year, having kind of never run a half marathon before. And, part of it was this, I wanted to prove to myself that I could do it, that it wasn't a Superman task. It required some discipline. It required some training, and that's good for me. Right. And I know I feel happier when I'm outside and exercising and signing up for, I try and keep like a half marathon on my calendar because it's the accountability I need,
right?
Like when I don't have one on my calendar, okay, it's raining, it's a little cold outside, and I'm like, well, maybe I'll just stay inside today, right?
Right,
but if I have one on my calendar, I'm like, oh no, I've got to train, right? So it provides me that little bit of extra I need to push myself. Another one that comes to mind, and this is, I of course study and teach Tai Chi. That's part of our class. And when I first, my Tai Chi teacher, Dr. Yang, is literally world famous. He's the most talented martial artist I have ever worked with. And I've worked with a lot of people. And when I first went out and started training with him, someone else there that I was training with at the time at his retreat center was getting ready to test under him. And I hadn't even thought of that, right? And so I had been doing martial arts for a while, but was new very much to training under him. And I asked him if I could test. And he said, yes, absolutely, you can test. You'll fail. But you can tell he's very blunt about it. That's kind of how he is. And true to form, I've continued to test under him over the years, and I have, there's a bunch of different skills tests at different ranks, and I have failed about half of the tests I have taken under him. And I'm told by others, other students of his and whatnot, that that's actually pretty normal and expected. And I understand some from also Chinese culture, there is what they call, they want to see that you're willing to eat bitter, is the phrase. And it's basically about hard work, that you don't come there thinking you already know it all. Because if you already know it all and you're just there to demonstrate it, then what does the teacher have to offer?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they want to see some demonstration of humility. They want to know that you're willing to risk failure because that's the only way you're honestly going to learn.
What?
And
so,
and for me, that was it. I was like, I'm okay with failure because I want the feedback. Mm-hmm. I wasn't doing it to pass, frankly. I was doing it because I wanted the feedback from this world famous teacher who is the most incredible martial artist I've ever studied under.
Well, I think that, already going a little off the rails because we didn't put doing hard things. We didn't explicitly put failure as a topic in today. But I think my dear friend Yoda saying like failure, the greatest teacher there is. Like it's so like, and as professors, we deal with young people who are often very risk averse because of that fear of failure. And like, how do we cultivating the appetite for hard things also means you have to have the stomach for failure as well.
Absolutely. I think they don't come up in an educational environment that supports it. Mm-hmm. Right? They, you know, they're focused on their GPA, and it's often not an environment. You know, we talk about this very explicitly, right? For example, this is the great surfing analogy. Mm-hmm. If you're afraid of falling off the board, you're never going to learn to surf.
Right.
Right. It makes it seems obvious when you talk about something like that, but if you talk about writing a research paper, suddenly everyone thinks they should be great the first time they do it.
Right.
Well, it's the same thing. There's actually a whole host of skills that go into that you are doing for the first time. If it's the first time you're doing it, you probably will suck and should suck because, right, you know, you're not, none of us are born Jedis. We like, right, that's the myth that people want. Like, okay, really, I'm just inherently insanely talented and I just need to be discovered, this like McDonald's Jedi thing. That's not real.
Yeah. Well, it's that sort of romanticism of the genius or the spontaneous that we think like there's something particularly special about Michael Phelps. He's double jointed, or he's got something else, but really he just worked really hard for a long time to get there.
Yeah. All right. He does have some incredible physical attributes as well.
Sure, right? Yeah.
So there is a genetic lottery component, but also, right, if he had won that genetic lottery and not trained, he wouldn't be Michael Phelps.
Right.
Right. So we're going to talk about grit, right?
Yep.
So let's talk about how about some like deliberately seeking out hardship.
Yeah, well, you know, and we're going to look a lot at sort of a variety of things. I tend to like to talk about these things in terms of the physical, because I feel like, as you sort of mentioned with the surfing, like it just provides some immediate feedback about the thing you are doing that sometimes you don't get in other areas. And I recently read, and I highly recommend, the book The Comfort Crisis by Michael Easter. It's a fantastic book. He talks a lot about how comfort is essentially killing us as a people, whether it's a sedentary life, right, the kinds of food we're eating, but also just about our inability to seek out hardship and challenge. Mm-hmm. And he references this concept. It comes from the Kojiki, forgive me if I'm mispronouncing that, it's a Japanese text written around the 8th century AD. And in that, they talk about a masogi. And my understanding of the masogi was that it was initially a cold water, sort of water purification, which I believe that's what masogi translates to, a sort of water purification. So it was like this cold water challenge that would leave you purified. It's now sort of expanded to mean like taking on a significantly hard challenge once a year, like, you know, like your marathon example, like having like a thing on the calendar, right, that the event should have a high likelihood of failure. So it's not really even about the success or the failure of the thing, but the engagement with that challenge. Mm-hmm. And the rationale, and this is why I also think, you know, we like to sort of triangulate some of these things, some ancient stuff some current science, and then what are some of the mechanistic components of all these things. But that's what's fascinating to me is like, and we heard this even talking about our students, like at the beginning of our semester, Phil and I teach a course called Ways of Well-Being. We take students on a surf trip to Costa Rica. Almost all of them said one of the things they hoped to get out of the class was getting outside of their comfort zone.
Yeah, I was struck by that.
It was so striking. And like, there's something about thinking about that masogi and the students, like there's something about us, has always been about us, that we crave moments where we're tested, where we find out who we are, and it's through that challenge that our truer self is revealed or built upon. I think that's really
And I think that they're not to put people into typologies, but I think of the big five personality inventory, which is kind of the most well-validated theory of personality. And one of the main factors is openness to new experience. Mm. And I think people who are higher in that attribute are probably more likely to want to move outside their comfort zone. It's literally how that kind of construct is defined. Mm. If you're low in openness to experience, you're more likely to find new things uncomfortable and turn away from them, right? So that means less foreign travel, less exposure to new ideas, new people, etc.
Well, and this may segue into our next topic on distress tolerance, but so I don't know, under that model, is that talking about them as fixed things, or can you build on them?
Well, so personality by definition is somewhat fixed, right? And I say somewhat fixed because it's not to say his personality doesn't change at all over time, but it is, as opposed to emotions, which fluctuate quite regularly, or how hungry you are fluctuates quite regularly. By definition, if we're calling it personality, then it should be a relatively stable through an extended period of time. But that doesn't mean that elements of kind of growth can't be taught. And so, yeah, so if we go into this concept of distress tolerance, for example, right? So distress tolerance is, I'm reading this, this is a 2016 study from the Journal of Mental Health and Prevention. Distress tolerance is defined as the ability to withstand and tolerate aversive psychological states. It has been shown to protect against many psychopathologies, such as post-traumatic stress disorder, borderline personality, and early dropout of substance use treatments, right? So it is this, you can think about it not as a binary, you either have it or you don't, but how much of it, right? And so, yes, you can, actually this article is about how mindfulness as a practice helps you increase your distress tolerance. So in this particular study, I guess I should also define resilience because that's one of the other things they focused on. So they looked at resilience is essentially the ability to bounce back after stress, right? So we know, you know, if we look at people who, whether it's in, you know, something quite severe, like a war situation where they face trauma or bad childhood events or whatever, or stress even in the workplace, some people bounce back more quickly than others. And that's referred to as resilience. And resilience is something that can be taught, right? There are built, tools for it, right? So mindfulness is one of them, right? So in this study, they used, this is the protocol that's known as mindfulness-based stress reduction. This was introduced by Jon Kabat-Zinn, which we talked about in episodes 2 and 3 when we talked about mindfulness. So it's a very specific mindfulness protocol. It is an 8-week training period. It's fairly intensive. And they matched, in this study, they had people essentially matched with what they call it's a control group. It's a matched control, meaning they measure people on a bunch of things and they try and make sure they're not different in any of the important categories. So, right, if you're measuring distress tolerance and resilience, you make sure that the control group on the group that's getting the mindfulness training has the same levels of that to start with. Mm. That's what the match control means. And so they put people through, this is an online program, so this is not in person, 8 weeks of mindfulness-based stress reduction. And they find that the group that goes through the MBSR training, at the end, they do have higher levels of mindfulness, but more importantly, higher levels of resilience and distress tolerance. Now, this is important because previous research had showed these things were correlated, but doing it like this in a study gets at the idea that it's actually a causation, right? Mm. That a deliberate mindfulness practice helps increase your resilience, helps increase your distress tolerance, right? And this is part of why we do this in class, right? And we recently used a protocol in class where we asked our students to think about, to pick a particular memory or issue that made them a little bit uncomfortable. And we say a little bit uncomfortable. We don't want you to pick the memory or thing in your life that you find overwhelming, right? That might have been incredibly traumatic for you, but something that is it's uncomfortable, but you can think about it without feeling too overwhelmed. And we asked them to sit for, it was a period of, I say, 5 or 10 minutes, and think about that issue. Think about how it, notice, how does it make you feel, right? What do you feel in your body in terms of your body's stress response? And, you know, when we talked with the students afterwards and said, you know, basically, what did you notice? One of the students said, I noticed my mind kept wanting to change topics, mm-hmm. right? Like there's this natural aversion. It's kind of like, you know, you have a stone in your shoe and you're just naturally going to favor the other foot, right? So mentally, we do the same thing. A thought where memory is uncomfortable, and we often avoid it. Think about hard conversations with people you're in relationships with or at work, and how many of us, it's hard to have difficult conversations. Sometimes it's easier to just not face it.
Yeah.
But if we're going to make progress, right, and we're going to address things, real problems, that we have to be able to tolerate a certain amount of distress. That's the distress tolerance.
Well, and even like... as a mindfulness exercise, even the very act of like sitting for 10 minutes, just noticing, even without the prompt of think about a difficult memory or something, just that act can be its own kind of low grade discomfort. Like the body, we're not used to sitting still. We're not used to just watching our thoughts. So even sitting through that 10 minutes can feel like a hard thing, even though it's not climbing Mount Everest, but it's just sitting still for 10 minutes for a lot of people can be challenging. And if you, and I think that's partly, I would argue, like part of the consistency of a mindfulness practice is daily sitting with those feelings, the thoughts, sitting with the body wanting to move and wanting things to be different, but just without judgment, sitting. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, exactly. And this distress tolerance, this relates to something similar that is used in psychotherapy that, you know, when you look at the literature on each one, you don't actually read much of a connection in terms of terminology, but these seem very similar to me. And this is the concept of exposure therapy, right? So exposure therapy has been around for a long time. It's used in what's often known as cognitive behavior therapy. And it's very well researched. It works very well for treating anxieties, for treating phobias, it is largely what it sounds like. You work with in this case a therapeutics situation where you might have pretty extreme anxiety or phobia. You work with a therapist to try and overcome that or learn to manage it. And the exposure therapy essentially involves low dose exposures to the things that makes you anxious or that you're afraid of, that you have the phobia of, and then coaching during that. So you build some skills ahead of time, frankly. Mindfulness is often a big part of this because you learn to notice your body's reaction and you learn to self-regulate through deep breathing or bringing your attention to things in the room. You learn many of the skills we talked about in episodes 2 and 3 when we talked about mindfulness. And so in the exposure therapy, you're essentially building a tolerance, right? For it's not that the anxiety or the fear, sometimes it never completely goes away. But what happens, how some of these things build, and we saw this, there was an increase, for example, in people's social anxiety around COVID, right? So you had COVID, you have a period of isolation where we were, to some extent, all told that we should be a little fearful going out in public. The goal wasn't to scare people, but the goal was to say, you should mask, you should limit your exposure, you should be more deliberate and thoughtful than you typically have been. Well, a lot of, especially people who might be immunocompromised or, you know, really then spend a lot of time in isolation and then re-entering social situations suddenly now is much more anxiety provoking than it was in the past. And so how you might do this with exposure therapy, if you were working with a therapist, is you might first just imagine going to You know, it's kind of that what we talked about with that mindfulness practice, right? Thinking about mm-hmm. something uncomfortable. If that's makes you uncomfortable, well, think about going to the supermarket. That's a fairly common one that people find difficult. And imagine yourself walking through it and notice how you feel, right? And what happens, and part of how anxieties and phobia reactions can build is when you go into a situation like that and you notice, you know, you might start to have a panic attack, your breath starts to increase, your respiration, your heart rate, and then you quickly leave. Well, as soon as you leave, all of those horrible symptoms start to go away, and you've essentially been rewarded for escaping the threat, mm-hmm. you know, or what your body was experiencing as a threat. So avoiding the social situation becomes reinforced. The more you do that, the more deeply you reinforce it. And this is how people wind up with kind of major social anxieties or anxieties of being in public places around other people, because they have unintentionally rewarded their body's reaction to that over and over by, well, and they'll even say things like, I'm going to do this until I feel uncomfortable and then I'll leave.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're not building any distress tolerance if that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
You're actually doing the opposite.
A little later today, we're going to talk about some of the mechanisms that may be in play specifically speaking to that. But I also think, like we were talking about our ways of well-being trip to Costa Rica, one of the things that we do on that trip is a waterfall rappelling tour.
Yes.
And I am definitely afraid of heights. But I also know there are expert guides with us, helping us. I'm surrounded by you and the students, like, and I'm in this beautiful place. So every time we go, my heart races. I get just and my mind starts racing. My palms get sweaty, and I have to use my breathing, focus on the environment. I have to go through that process because it doesn't go away. I think it gets.
Yeah.
It gets easier to the degree that I know that I think this is the other thing, because I know I've done this before and I've chosen to do this before.
Yes.
I think that intentionality is a critical feature of this, that I went to the hard thing and did it. Yeah. I've got that memory to say, you're going to get through this again today. You're going to be scared. Notice that it's not going to go. If it doesn't go away, fine. So be it. Right. Yeah. But you've done this, you know, you can do this. And that gets me through. And one of the other things that I notice, and I think, you know, a lot of people will recognize that there's a point at which that fear starts to let go. Mm-hmm. It's anticipatory. Fear is by nature anticipatory. I fear what could happen. And then you learn going through it, oh, it's probably not going to happen. And that fear subsides a little over. So every time we go on that waterfall, I start scared. By the end of it, I'm just joyful.
So right. So just briefly on the mechanism. So habituation is when you get repeated exposure to something, and assuming it doesn't end badly, by
right,
the way.
Right.
You survive.
Yeah.
Nothing traumatic happens. Well, then there is a gradual reduction of fear. And extinction is what we call kind of the process of breaking that link between stimulus and response. And in this case, for what you're describing, the stimulus is the height, mm-hmm. right? And the response is fear. And this is, when we do this, there are like four waterfalls. I think the first one is about 40 feet. The last one is 100, 120 feet. It's big. And, you know, I wouldn't describe myself as having a fear of heights other than to say, like, well, yeah, I mean, I have a natural fear. Like, I think everyone, almost everyone, I should say, has a natural fear of heights because it's just hardwired into us, right?
Right.
But I am with you. Every time I do it, you're on the platform or the top of the waterfall, and you're leaning butt first over the edge, you know, and I'm looking between my legs at, you know, 100 feet down. And just like you, I'm like, okay, breathe in,
breathe
out. Right. And it is a very deliberate breath mm-hmm. practice for me. And what I also heard you say, and this is what I hear our students say over and over again, which I love. They say, I would never have mm-hmm. done something like this, but I did it.
And I'm so glad I did it.
I'm glad I did it mm-hmm. because my willingness now to do hard things in the future, mm-hmm. right? I've just increased my self-efficacy, my self-confidence. So this is a big part of why we have this section called Do Hard Things in the class and as part of this podcast, because you are, by avoiding it, right, you are essentially kind of building the fear, building the anxiety. By engaging it, you're actually increasing your sense of self-efficacy, your sense of self-confidence. And sometimes the fear or anxiety completely goes away, but other times it doesn't. I mean, every time we've done this, I don't know, 5-6 times we've done this waterfall rappelling, and I find it scary every time. Yes, it's gotten better, but my heart rate goes up, my breathing goes up every single time. And one of the things that was helpful for me is that I totally slipped and my hands fell off the rappelling ropes and everything. And you know, I didn't fall.
Right.
And yeah. So that exposure, that was part of okay, that's good, right? That's part of the point of exposure therapy, is you put yourself in it and you realize like, oh, it wasn't actually as bad as I may have made out the fear in my mind.
And one of the other things about talking about that masogi, that hard thing, it has this sort of resonating capacity. So an event like that, particularly possibly for many of our students, reverberates throughout the year, throughout their life. They'll remember that moment and link it metaphorically, conceptually to other aspects. Like I have rappelled down waterfalls. I can take this test.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and that's what we want. And that's how we talk about it. We want that self-efficacy to generalize. Mm-hmm. So it's not just about the one thing, right? Now, if you're going to a therapist to treat an anxiety or a phobia for a specific thing, and you've lived with it for a long time, it might take a long time actually to kind of recover from that, right? Like if it's, for example, the supermarket, you might have to continue that exposure for a long period of time. Or you mentioned fear of heights, right? Kind of that continued exposure. The more you avoid it, the more you're going to build the fear, the more you expose yourself, the more it says you're going to kind of habituate and to kind of break that link between stimulus and response.
So let's talk about so you've got this hard thing, you want to get through it, you want to, like, what are some of the things that we can build, capacities we can build to help us get through those hard things?
In terms of like steps, you mean? Or,
well, we can talk about sort of three sort of co-related, like grit, growth mindset. And tenacity.
Yeah.
Tenacity and grit are similar, but we can maybe tease those apart a little bit. But can you give us a little background on grit?
Yeah, sure. So, grit, this is Angela Duckworth's model, and it's really about persistence and the impact of effort, right? I really like the idea because I think too many of us have this narrative, and we've been brought up in a society that makes us think that we're either born inherently good at something or we're not, right? So I hear this, for example, around even like leadership. Like this idea that, you know, great leaders, well, you're either just born a great leader or you're not. Actually, I think that's a skill that can be trained. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about growth mindset, right? Which gets there. But grit is this idea that it's basically your willingness to persevere to push through something. So there's a grit scale that Angela Duckworth and other research has used, and some positive items on the scale are things like setbacks don't discourage me, I don't give up easily. The more you agree with that, the higher you are on grit. Another item, I have overcome setbacks to conquer an important challenge. I'll give you an example of that for me. I did a half marathon. No, it was a triathlon. It was a sprint one, so it's fairly short, but I've never done a triathlon before this, and the day before, you know, in our nutrition episodes, we discussed, you know, I've had some gluten intolerances. Mm-hmm. I had something, I don't know what I ate. It wiped me out. I was on the couch the whole day before feeling horrible. So, you know, so the next morning, I mean, that's not what you want physically, right, going into a new challenge for yourself. But I viewed it as grit. I was like, you know I'm not going to be at my best on this day because my energy is where it is. That's actually some part of this what we're talking about is this idea of radical acceptance. You are where you are. That's okay. But I do want to finish it, and that's my goal, right? So I, knowing that I was in a weakened state, and that was part of what I learned, was that in any given day, your energy is going to be up, your energy is going to be down. The perseverance itself pays off. And I tell my students that often there is no secret to getting good at something other than being too stubborn to quit and engaging in deliberate practice. There's a classic book in karate called There Are No Secrets. That's actually what it's about. Because students always want that, like, what's the secret? When I teach Tai Chi, they'll be like, oh, you know, I've been practicing the form and I keep getting stuck at this one spot. And I say, oh, do you want to know the secret? And they're like, what? And I said, practice. And they look at me, you know, with that look, and I'm like, but I am practicing. Yeah. Practice more, right? Mm-hmm. So grit is this willingness to persevere. And the higher you rate on it, essentially the more willing you are to push through. And it's not to say that, you know, effort is the only thing that matters. Obviously, there are other things that matter, but effort counts a lot. Mm-hmm. So this, I think, is related to a concept called growth mindset. And growth mindset is it's growth versus fixed mindset. And when we talk about growth mindset, it is it has a lot to do with how you interpret feedback in your environment and how you think about your own abilities, right? So if you think, well, I'm no good at this thing, and I never will be good at this thing, then when you get feedback of failure in your environment, you're not going to persist, right? You're going to take that as kind of self-confirming. So imagine a school situation, right, where I think I'm not a good student, I never will be. I get a bad grade on a test, and I think, see, right? Right. And then I don't try. So it becomes self. It's a self-fulfilling belief at that point, right? Go ahead.
And I think, and also what I often try to remind students is, like, it's not a binary.
No.
You're not either fixed or a growth person. There are different areas in your life where you might be growth. You might have a fixed mindset about this thing. And, you know, just finding out, like, for me, that swimming this morning was probably rooted in a sort of a fixed mindset around that. And that's a great place to look at, like, okay, how can I transform that experience for myself into a growth opportunity?
Exactly. That's the people who are higher, and again, it's teachable, right? This is something you can deliberately cultivate in yourself. When you notice that self-talk of I'm no good at this, and I never will be, to say, well, actually, maybe I should change how I'm approaching it, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe I should change my strategy. Maybe I need to go to study hall. Maybe I need a mentor, whatever it is. And then the higher you are on that growth mindset, the more likely you are to persist, essentially, the higher your grit will be. You know, Angela Duckworth, right? So Carol Dweck, by the way, is the growth versus fixed mindset, if you're looking that up. And it is a big thing. I mean, I think there is a value to being, in a way, too stubborn to quit. I mean, I talk openly with my students about kind of my martial arts experience and my music experience, because martial arts for me has always come more naturally, right? It's not that there aren't some natural affinities. I have always found that easier to learn. I seem to have taken to it more quickly. Music, which I absolutely love. I play bass. I play in a band. That did not come natural to me, right? It seemed like everyone else had a better ear than I did. My timing and feel was good, but not my ear. And that's a really hard thing for a musician. But I've been playing since high school, you know, since my freshman year in high school. So that's a lot of perseverance, despite the fact that it was not something that came natural to me. And the result is that now I'm pretty good at it. So, you know, some of what I see with my Tai Chi students or whatever and anything is that, well, most people just quit, right? If you stick with something for 10 years, guess what? You're going to be pretty good at it.
And a lot of people might have already, you've probably heard just in the ether, sort of the 10,000 hour rule. That was coined by Malcolm Gladwell in his book Outliers, and it's based on work by Anders Ericsson. And what's interesting about that is Gladwell kind of got, he kind of got it wrong. Like Anders Ericsson never said 10,000 hours makes you an expert.
Yeah.
He, what he was really pointing to, he said that he was looking at particularly violinists and he was saying it's about 10 years to become a master.
Deliberate practice.
Oh, and that's the important thing. It's 10 years or 10,000 hours of what? The what is the important thing. It's deliberate practice. And that's where, you know, if you could just go out and play pickup basketball with your friends on Saturday, you're never going to really get better at basketball. You have to drill the problem areas, the things you're not good
exactly.
at. And that requires you getting into that uncomfortable space and practicing, as you said before.
Yeah, yeah. So this is probably a good time to transition into some of the biology around kind of tenacity and what we know in terms of brain regions related to this.
Yeah. So, you know, I think a lot of people would probably equate grit, tenacity, perseverance, all as sort of different words for some of the same things. And they likely are. I think I've parsed them out to think about grit as sort of the external manifestations of tenacity, which is an internal experience. That may just be my categories.
Yeah. I think of sandpaper. So, you know, this grit is the measurement of actually of how they come in different grits is what this is called.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So whatever you call it, like if you think about tenacity, you know, we've talked about sort of like how out throughout history, out in the world, we can execute and stick with these things, stick with the hard things. But what's fascinating is that they have direct neurobiological mechanisms that may be at play. And this is like super new research in neuroscience. It's like only a couple years old. And they've located this area called the anterior mid-cingulate cortex, or AMCC. And you have two of them, and they're part of a larger brain structure called the cingulate cortex. It's about a third of the way back from your forehead. And the AMCC has a whole bunch of different responsibilities. Everything from emotional regulation, motivation, willpower, and even some scientists are saying not only is it responsible for willpower, it may be responsible for your will to live, which is fascinating.
That's like that, big. That's big picture.
It's big bets, right? And what's fascinating is like when you do hard things and when you do hard things in particularly that you don't want to do, it gets bigger, it gets stronger. We talked last week or last time in the nutrition about BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is this like miracle grow for the brain.
Yeah, yeah.
Exercise builds it up. Good food, particularly Mediterranean diet, builds it up. Doing hard things
builds up this region, right?
This is
activity-dependent neuroplasticity, right? This is, and this is what we see with mindfulness meditation as a sustained attention task. Mm-hmm. It thickens the areas of the brain involved in attention. So basically saying this is the area of the brain involved in willpower, perseverance, grit, tenacity, you know, what are these, all these different words, but this is the area that actually thickens. And so the practice of deliberately doing hard things builds your capacity to do hard things going forward. And you talk about the will to live,
right?
You know, aging, you know, as people get older, boy, it is hard, right? You know, even at, you know, our age, you know, in the 50s, mm-hmm. right, you know, experiencing like, oh gosh, you know, the hip and this and that. And I, to imagine at 80, mm-hmm. you know, and I think about, what I've seen in what I see now in my parents and what I've seen in my grandparents, mm-hmm. aging is not easy.
Right. Well, and that's what they're also seeing with the AMCC is that super agers, people who not only live longer but flourish longer, this region is more developed. So, in people who are obese, who are sedentary, who don't engage in hard things, it. Use it or lose it, it starts to shrink. So I think in my brain, I'm linking what you said earlier, like when you shy away from hard things, it makes it, you know, that wall gets closer and closer and makes doing hard things even harder and harder and harder. That there may be a very specific biological mechanism at play here, that it literally is shrinking, causing you to engage less with those hard things, which is, I think, you know, again, this podcast isn't about sort of getting into the nuts and bolts and the weeds on these things, but I always like to like triangulate these things. Like,
yeah,
this isn't just a concept. There are actual changes.
Mechanisms.
There are
mechanisms. Physical mechanisms.
Things, and they are changing because of what I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is just fascinating. We are about out of time.
Yeah.
We want to set up what's our challenge?
So,
for this week, I
think this is a highly personal one, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of, I think the challenge this week for all of our listeners is to pick something that is a challenge for you, that is a hard thing for you to do. And this could be a mental thing. It could be an emotional thing. It could be a physical thing. But set some goals around engaging in it on a somewhat regular basis, right? So, obviously you want to pick something that is an actual goal of yours. You're not doing it just because it's hard. You're doing it because it actually helps with goal attainment, right? Something important in your life. Like, so for me, the mindfulness, I find sometimes my mindfulness practice challenging to just sit for 20 minutes a day, because I always, part of it is my own, workload anxiety. I always have better things I could be doing with my time, quote unquote, right?
Right, right.
But I know that when I have a regular mindfulness practice, I'm calmer, I'm more centered, I'm more functional in my life. I bring the best of me mm-hmm. to more of my situations. So that's the goal part, right? It's part of why I do that, because I actually feel like a happier, healthier person when I do it. And the same with running for me. So that's the challenge. Pick a hard thing, whether it's exercise, sitting, right? Having some difficult conversations, right? I think these are essential in relationships. That's personal relationships, professional relationships. You have to be able to talk about hard things if you're going to address them. Avoidance is generally not the right strategy. So with that being said, that's all, folks. Subscribe to the Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube, and we will be sure to respond. Be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook. And if you have questions or comments, or there's a subject you want to hear us discuss, please reach out to thriveologylab@gmail.com. Thrive on, Neil.
Thrive on, Phil.